Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, that's a fact, because I'm a professional who's right in front of his microphone.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, guys. What's going on?
He was sticking his tongue out at us. It's a very strange thing. You've never been happier to be listening to this just on the audio version than you should be right now. So, gentlemen, I'm going to jump right into things. And guess what, folks? This is going to be a SpaceX-heavy podcast. And probably the next one will be, too, because on this Tuesday, Super Tuesday, well, for space... Elon Musk is doing his announcement explaining the SpaceX plan for Mars, and we're going to give a little bit of historical context to this and why this is, in my opinion, a really, really big deal. Now, first up, not surprising, anybody who was like listening to us make some predictions, I think. On Friday, SpaceX announced a preliminary report about what they think the cause was for the Falcon 9 blowing up on the pad, and it had to deal with helium pressurization in a tank and some sort of breach system. So not conclusive, but they said, we think this is the case here, and they're still hoping to be able to launch again in November. And the reason they wanted to do this and get an announcement out of the way is for Elon Musk to go out and talk about going to Mars. Didn't want that dangling in front of them.
That makes sense. That seems like a smart move to just own the fact that it's like, yeah, we're doing something nobody's ever done before. And guess what comes along with that? A lot of exploding rockets. Like, let's all just get used to it right now, because so many rockets are going to explode between now and when we all live on Mars. So are y'all done? You done chuckling? Y'all done giggling? Am I exploding robots, rockets?
Yeah, hopefully fewer and fewer, but yeah, I think it's own up to it. So yeah, something happened, but you know, we're moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is the grand equation, the grand sum of everything else that they have done that allows them to move past failures like this. Because, you know, Brian, Elon Musk has said that they were going to blow up a lot of rockets trying to re-land one, right? But rockets blowing up on the launch pad or before they get to orbit is a problem comparatively to what they have demonstrated they've been able to do in the past. So I think this is something that they definitely do have to address, because whether you like it or not, this is a kind of narratively driven game, considering the fact that there's not a ton of people that buy this kind of product, you know, the space on a rocket to deploy stuff. And if that limited consumer base dries up or loses faith in you, then you have serious problems very, very quickly.
Yeah. No, I think you're 100% right. It does make me think. Can we talk ever so briefly about how bad humans are at predicting the future and coming up with sensible timelines? It seems like we either vastly underestimate how soon something's going to happen, or we vastly overestimate how around the corner it is. Like, I'm thinking about the movie Demolition Man, and like giant cultural sociological changes just, you know, happening willy-nilly. But then I think about reality and about how 20 years ago, I don't think a human being I know would have said that we were less than 20 years away from gay marriage and marijuana being legal, you know, in the world.
I really wanted you to be like, you know, can we talk about how unrealistic timelines are? Like, Bonnie asked me to take out the trash, and she has an that's going to happen 24 to 72 hours. But science and history says that that's totally unrealistic.
James Randi says,
you know, for a comparison, there's an industry launch rate. And, you know, I think launchers, some of the more traditional ones, have had an amazing success rate. And they've built on technology that existed for 40 years prior and had that advantage to do that. And once they announced this is the new rocket, but using that older tech, they could have a very successful launch rate. For newer tech, it's difficult. You know, SpaceX has done something like 28 Falcon 9 launches, and yeah, two of them have been blown up. One out of 15, not the best marketing in the world, shuttle, space shuttle, two horrific accidents killing a dozen people each one, or I mean, killing, you know, total, 134 launches. So like one out of 60 of those shuttle launches blew like up.
Two percent failure rate, two percent like roll of the dice, and I guess that's it's so crazy, a lot of parse here. What do you think he's going to say in the? If we're speculating wildly,
well, let me give a. I'm going to give some context. I did a little research prior to the podcast to sort of figure out like what I think the sort of this the significance is, and I'm going to add here. I wrote an essay called How to Make Money on Mars, getting into the economics of that, which we can talk about later. And if you go to my authorpage.com/AndrewMaine, it's there. And I have a SoundCloud link. But we're going to put that into the special Patreon feed, by the way, the audio version of that. If that feels special to you, you can listen to it. If it doesn't feel special to you, you don't have to listen to it. But give you some context here. In 1832, Dr. Hartwell Carver published an article in the New York Courier and Inquirer advocating the building of a transcontinental railroad from Lake Michigan to Oregon. In 1847, he submitted a memorial to Congress entitled Proposal for a Charter to Build a Railroad from Lake Michigan to Pacific Ocean. His plan was he looked at the United States and how vast it was and thought, man, if we connected one end to the next from side to side, it would totally change, you know, the landscape. It would change the country. It would increase commerce. And it certainly did. We became an economic superpower in part because of our ability to unite the country with a rail system. Now, further forward, in 1918, E.J. Marin, a civil engineer and editor of the Engineering News Record, presented his suggestion for a national highway policy and plan. And this was the first big proposal for an interstate highway system. Now, it took us another 40 years before we finally built that under Eisenhower. But one of the things we have as an advantage of we're such a large country, but we have an amazing highway system that we had this 50, 60 years before anybody else did. And it was an extreme benefit for us economically. And then I would say arguably the next big thing that happened, you could say that, you know, one of the things I didn't put in the list is like the development of the cargo container, the standardized unit of container for shipping.
Yeah, dude, shipping containers is huge. There was a 99% Invisible recently that was talking about just how much that transformed everything.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That it's hard to understand, like, what's a box do? But the box, the idea is that you could take this box in, you know, Michigan, load machinery into this thing, put it in there, and reliably know that it was going to end up halfway around the world in Europe to some people buying it for France or whatever. It didn't have to be offloaded, unloaded, whatever. You could track that box. You could track everything. It is a very important part of our economic system is the fact that we have this standardized unit for sending stuff around the world. In 1982, an amazing thing happened, and that was that we had a number of these different computer networks. We had ARPANET, but all these major computer initiatives at different universities and corporations and research centers had their own protocols for having their computers talk to each other in their local networks. In 1982, we agreed on the standardization of TCP/IP, which was saying, okay, here's how you get your system over there in Cleveland to talk to the system in Santa Clarita and to get them to talk to London. So all these computers can have different hardware, different operating systems, but they can use this system for packaging information back and forth. And that was the standardization of that system. Because revolutionary. Arguably, that's when the internet really started, was 1982. We can trace the roots to other things. Moving forward, in 1993, when CERN, when Tim Berners-Lee announced the protocol for the World Wide Web and said, it's free to use, everybody can use this. This is a way to post information on your computer. Again, whatever operating system you have, that's fine. Whatever you're doing, it doesn't matter. This is how to post information. And then you had Mark Andreessen with a browser, which made it very easy for regular people to use it. Where, and next thing you know, boom. This thing called the World Wide Web and the internet took off. So these things are fascinating to me. You know, going back almost, you know, 430 plus years or 420 years, we have the East India Company, which was this economic development pact to, you know, maybe exploit the rest of the world. But it was saying, man, we think there's, you know, we're a tiny little country in England, but we think that if we join together and we plan our resources right, we can go over there and we can trade with other countries and, you know, build our private armies and take them over, which, you know, maybe there wasn't a lot of happy parts to that, but it was an amazing enterprise in world exploration. So these things are the thing, the context at which I look at what Elon Musk is about to do. Now, the obvious connection people would say is like, oh, well, it's like Kennedy saying we're going to go to the moon. The moon initiative, amazing, incredible human achievement, but that was the goal of going to the moon was to go to the moon, not to develop a transportation infrastructure, not to develop an economic model, not to develop a business case. It was to just go to the moon. And once we went to the moon, and the last time we went was 1972, we stopped doing that. And we have not been, and Brian's pointed out this repeatedly, it has been 44 years, 44 years since humans left Earth orbit. Not even going to the moon, just leaving the orbit of Earth.
Just physically being able to see the Earth in your field of vision. Like, and yes, space is way, way up there, but it's the equivalent of looking at the planet Earth like you're hugging a basketball right next to your eye.
I was telling my parents the International Space Station is just 220 miles up. And that was like, really? That's, I'm like, yeah, that's as far as we've gone. That's as far as we've gone in half of a century, in half a century. And I'm going to make the argument right now, the model of it's got to be government initiatives first has not worked, has not worked. It's been a failure for half of a century. There needs to be a private component to this for people to argue, well, we should do this. We should do this with the government. We should do this first and foremost. Guess what? We haven't. So maybe it's time for us to really encourage people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and to say, yeah, that's our future in space.
This is a really good point. Justin, why are you voting for Johnson Weld in 2016?
Well, wait, what?
No, I'm just that we veered into political territory.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little preaching to the choir here. Like, wow, what a shocking turn of events. The Weird Things podcast supports private space travel. I think it is very, very relevant to point out that, like, what I assume that you are getting to, Andrew, is that this announcement could very well be something that when we look back in magnitude is very much an echo of some of those others that you mentioned, things that might not have seemed like gigantic deals then, but certainly shaped our world.
Yeah, that's the context I say that we need to look at it. It's not just, hey, we're going to go to Mars. It's we're building highways. He's announcing rockets and architecture. We presume, again, it could be all like, ha-ha, idiots, you fell for it. He's announcing a plan, a business case, or part of the starting of a business case for why we're going to go there, why we're going to go back and forth, and how to continuously do this. Not a one-time, let's put a person, it's not a, don't look at it as just this exploratory mission. It is building a business case for the continual development of a Martian infrastructure.
And I think you made a point before we started recording that it's the difference between driving a vehicle, an experimental vehicle from New York to L.A., or building a railroad that goes from New York to L.A.
The goal of the Highway Act was not to, like, let's send a car from New York to California. And wouldn't that be amazing if we did that? The Highway Act was, let's make it so cars can go from New York to California. The railroad was, hey, let's not see if steam-powered locomotion can make it from one end of the country to the other. It's like, let's make it so we have steam-powered, you know, we have powered locomotives going back and forth because we think those are the benefits. And that's not what we've done previously. We've developed these single-use technologies that were ridiculously expensive via Apollo, Space Shuttle, and again, SLS. SLS, the Space Launch System, is this $2 billion-per-launch rocket that it does not have any real benefits outside of just having a really fast kick-ass rocket, but it's not a form of, you know, commerce. It's not a form of infrastructure. It's not the kind of thing that's really going to open up space in the way it should be.
Real quick, that is sort of the elephant in the room, right? Where it's like we all think that there's a benefit to going to space just for the fact that you're in space. And I know that there – or I've heard – I actually don't even know this, but I've heard that there are certain medicines that can only be chemistrized in microgravity or whatever. Outside of that, and I'm sure there's significant data to be gleaned about what it's like to be weightless floating around the Earth, the ISS isn't a economic powerhouse the way a reliable transit to and from Mars could be. You know, there's going to be There's going to be resources on Mars. There's going to be, space. Literal, room to do things that are free of the entanglements of all kinds of things. I don't know.
Part of it we've already just seen already. Unfortunately, the SpaceX rocket that blew up was, had Facebook's first satellite in it. And think whatever you want of Facebook, but they're not traditionally the kind of company that would see a benefit of putting a satellite into orbit. The more that you make these things regular, dependable, and cheap, the more you will see a willingness for people to find this as a solution. Economics, as explained by a former Magic blogger.
In my essay, I call it How to Make Money on Mars. One of the things I make the point of is that the goal really isn't necessarily the real goal, the long-term benefit isn't from we discover some magical material, some sort of special property or things like that can only be made on space or found on Mars, which is what we think it is. And that's sort of the traditional mindset that's, hey, we're going to go there to find this thing and that'll justify. The reality of economics is people went to California because of the gold rush, because there was gold. Then people stayed in California because it was interesting. If you were a little bit out there kind of thinker, there was an advantage to that. Several years later, when aircraft industries wanted to test stuff and that they liked the weather, they were there. And then you started attracting technology firms. Shockley, the founder of the creator of the transistor, came to California because he grew up here. He loved it. And then he went to Silicon Valley when he started his transistor company. And next thing you know, we have this incredible boom and we have an amazing, a leading world economy concentrated in one small area. So as we go to Mars, the first money is going to be speculation. The first money is going to be hoping to find things. I make the case for the economic case for sort of the different stages of where you derive value from going to Mars. If Elon Musk, if you guys want, I can go into a little bit, but I don't want to just, totally just dominate it with that point. But I'll make a couple quick points, and that is, you can pay for your initial mission by saying, hey, what's the first kiloton of Martian materials and rocks brought back worth? You auction that stuff off because for putting that into, you can take dust and dope diamonds and make reddish diamonds. You can create all these stupid luxury goods, though, that will have a tremendous amount of value, and you can create things on that level. Then when you start doing experiments and looking for resources and finding what's there, there's an incredible infrastructure to build up from that. But on top of that, once you're getting tens of thousands of people on Mars doing this stuff, doing advanced robotics research and developing space systems and sustainable habitats and stuff, you start developing incredible information and technology systems where your next generation of startups and companies are going to come probably from this concentration of brilliant people there working there and brilliant people working on Earth and developing new models and systems for trying to figure out how we live in space. And Mars becomes like Silicon Valley or Singapore. There's the reason we all went there was, one point, but then the reason it expands is because of the benefits of that.
Well, and that's just a matter of being there.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, just a lot of times, I mean, again, it is the exploitation of resources because they are resources, because we can get there, there's a lot of these angles that we'll probably, continue to see more the more we fully understand it. I mean, the other question is, how much of what we know about Mars right now will be hilariously outdated at the point where we begin making regular physical trips there? We don't even know.
We've had some NASA's developed some incredible rover technology that's given us stunning pictures and examples of what's on the surface of there. We've only been able to just literally take drills and scratch a little bit in there, and it's an entire planet because there's no water there. It's got the same surface area basically that Earth has, and we don't know what we're going to find. And it may not be, we may not find things that are it's changed everything we know about the world and the universe, but it becomes this amazing area of exploration that harnesses our intellect. It gives us a focus. I think that we're due for a really good technological focus right now. I think we're due for something that's going to apply information technology, robotics, and pushing the human frontier. I look at it I think there's going to be a space boom, in low Earth orbit. And I think calling it Mars and saying, let's go to Mars is sort of the overview for really let's go into space now and really push the frontiers. I think that's the next big economic boom for the world and will push us into a whole new level.
So, man, I am just skimming through your thing on author page. There is nary an angle uncovered. You have got it going on in this one, my friend. This is great.
So I wanted to sort of illustrate, one, how you finance the mission, how you make money from the mission, and then how it develops into something bigger. And Brian, you might be interested. One of the things I think is imagine if you said, we're going to take the first kiloton of material. One, you can auction that stuff off, and Gucci, Louis Vuitton, and everybody else is going to want to buy the stuff because you want to, you know, hey, get the new iPhone Rose Martian Gold, not really Martian Gold, which is dust and butane or whatever. But then another thing you can do is I have talking of getting into currencies and financial instruments. Imagine you were going to take the first kiloton of Martian rock, bring it back, grind it down, and put it into coins, like not make coins from, but embed it into coins and say that this is the first minting of a Martian coin made from Martian material. We're going to make 5 million of these. We're going to have 5 million. It's going to only do one print run of this, 5 million. We're going to sell 100,000 of them up front. Who wants to buy one at $1,000?
Like, are you asking, do I think that's a thing that somebody will do, or?
Well, I think that would be the, you know, Mars, you know, SpaceX or something, that's a thing to do that. But I think, would you think that there's a value to that?
There would, insofar as, you know, one of the problems, there would, insofar as you would finally have the world's first truly uncounterfeitable currency. Like just flat out, unless there have been clandestine, missions to Mars that nobody, you know, knows about, you would be able to verify that this coinage was, you know, part of the print run that it did. I got to admit, that's not the first place I would have gone for thinking of it, but that's a very, very clever.
Well, I go into a lot of
provide
places.
Value, I mean, right away.
There's the obvious low-hanging fruit of corporate sponsorships, things like that. But I think as actual as a percentage, that's far less than what people kind of think the value compared to cost of Mars. Do you know the total value of the Bitcoin market right now?
100% of Bitcoins?
$10 billion. $10 billion US.
That's not bad. That's not a lot, though, right?
I mean, it's for a currency that's completely artificial and arbitrary. I mean, all currencies are arbitrary, but for a currency that's not even a Beanie Baby sort of currency, but a currency that is just this recent kind of currency because it's different and it has this uniqueness or whatever to it. It's a $10 billion market right now for Bitcoin, which I've long been a big Bitcoin skeptic. And in the applications it's been used for, the ones that I feared at the onset, which is online extortion, things like that. The untraceability is very attractive to people. There is a need for these kinds of currencies, absolutely. And I think the blockchain is a fascinating problem. So I think the first wave is you can do a coinage sort of thing, the idea of like, this is how you sort of pay. And it has that sort of the idea of the value would increase, you know, because it's one time, the first mission return. The second phase is I get into sort of explaining how you could do a Martian minted currency on the planet that sort of has blockchain functionality to it and the advantage of that. And it's tied into sort of investment in further Martian exploration, et cetera. So kind of like issuing promissory notes or stamps or things like that. And that's how these things have been historically capitalized in the past, though. When you wanted to build the railroad, you wanted to do these other things, you did bonds, you did special currencies, you did these kinds of things. That's the way we did it before. And I think that's the way we're going to do it now, but with our 21st century sort of insight into what makes these things better.
So is it part of your thesis that, let's say for, you know, sake of discussion, this does become the dominant form of currency on Mars? Is it inherently independent? Is it not tied to any kind of governmental institution? Is that an important part of how you frame all that? Real quick, just to clarify, the reason I ask is because Mars seems a lot like Hong Kong. Hong Kong essentially has nothing going for it in terms of natural resources. It's just a dock with nothing but rocks and British government that promised to do one thing, enforce contracts and drink tea. And out of that, it became a haven for trading. And of course, it seems like Mars, there's a reason I suspect that Elon Musk is attracted to it, as are a bunch of other, neo-libertarian Silicon Valley types or whatever. Do you think that we're headed towards that kind of situation again?
I think, I actually mentioned that Hong Kong is an example of that, of countries, of places that are resource poor, but have become economic powerhouses. And so the idea of you doing, you know, issuing Martian bonds or investment vehicles or whatever as a way to eventually fund it, and but then to start do initial funding, but then how that can grow into absolutely what you just said, because it, you don't want to go out there and say, listen, we need the participation of the world governments. It's not like, hey, we're going to land there and create this libertarian paradise. No, it's not going to happen like that. You know, it's going to be ideally under the flag of, you know, preferably like the United States or some, you know, country that supports freedom of speech, things like that. That's going to be an essential part of it. NASA's going to have to be part of this. NASA's got an amazing resources and, you know, wherewithal to do that. They're just not in a position where they can lead these kinds of programs anymore because of the limitations they have, the bipartisan problems and all that sort of stuff. But the idea is that once you're – and you don't want to go there like, yeah, we're going to go there and thumb our nose at Earth. That ain't going to happen. But it is going to be like, hey, let's take the things that have worked really well that we agree across the board that work that we can then implement there and sort of start fresh like a free trade zone, you know, a Martian free trade zone in effect. You know, and that's – free trade zones have been very effective economically because part of what you're allowed to do is like, yeah, all these other rules and things like that we do, let's start it over again and we'll think through like maybe we need to have some good environmental rules here. Maybe we need to have some good stuff here, but let's not put 30,000 different laws and taxes
and
things
on place. Hold on. No. And I'm assuming you talk about this in your article, but like that could be huge. If there is, let's say it's an outpost of, you know, the size of this studio and it's manned by two people who sit there all the time. Even if all they do is offer complete confidentiality for trades between buyers and sellers on planet Earth, so they know that all the records of this transaction exist in outside of all jurisdictions, outside of like, you know, 15 minutes just for light to get back and forth in there. That alone will have incredible economic value.
I agree, but I did not get into that. And I in my follow-ups, I point out like why you wouldn't really want to push forward like you know legal immunities or things like that initially, because you're not going to get the support of the nations of the Earth that you need. If our goal is like, yeah, we're going to do this so we can create a tax haven, you know, you're going to get less enthusiasm because you need people, you need Earth countries and stuff like that to support that. If they look at it like, well, no, you're just going to go there, so then everybody can offshore their money and we're going to deplete our tax base if the goal is to defy tax regulator stuff. But yeah, I think for a data haven, a wonderful place. It's like, oh yeah, you need this? Well, you got to go to Mars. You know, you look at countries like how Switzerland function, Delaware functions,
yep.
You know?
Yep. I mean, and again, I'm not saying that's the way they should do, but if Brian, it's there,
look at me. No, we shouldn't do it.
Just something in your eye, buddy. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, if what you want is a reason for people with billions of dollars to say, take a couple of these billions and figure out a way to get to Mars, that's the kind of thing they're going to be interested in.
I think that's why the money will be there to fund a Mars. And I, because I read an article that talked about Elon Musk will announce his mission, but you know it's going to cost $100 billion, and you know only the government could pay for this. I'm like, you know, we put about $1 trillion into the internet economy that got wiped out. I kind of think that if people better understand the economic models and everything else at play there, it's. If you look at it like, yeah, no, that's new. It's the new world again, but this time without the genocide. You know, it's the new world again. That's a little bit more, you know, moral, hopefully. That's the economic boon that you're looking at and all the advantages that come from there. And again, it's not a matter of like, yeah, and because we found this material, it's because all this intellectual ability, all this financial capital, all these things coming together, and you get these incredible outgrowths. The next Ubers, the next incredible Facebooks, the next incredible companies that are going to come about. And, you know, sometimes we go, well, those are just information companies. Well, yeah, that's the future. As everything else becomes a commodity and manufacturing goes to the floor in what you get
Wouldn't that be one of the first things? Like, let's say if you wanted to do something truly altruistic, then the first priority would be, once you get to Mars, is to take the sum total of human knowledge and get it off our Petri dish into another Petri dish so that we have redundancy.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I make a point, and I think one of my follow-ups to the article is the first flag we should plant on Mars should be, I think, a flag that's a photo of the Earth. You know, it should be, tell everybody go outside, and we can do one side of each flag can be each hemisphere. Everybody go outside, wave. this is what it needs to be. Not a political flag, not a UN flag, not an American flag. It should be a flag of the earth, and just say, okay, this is who's coming here, because this is a mission that belongs to everybody. And if you're some schoolgirl in Sri Lanka watching this on TV, you should feel as much pride as, you know, some kid from, you know, a rocket factory in Huntsville, Alabama, wherever. You know, you should feel that you're part of this. It should be a – it is a – worldwide mission, and that's what I see it as. It's human potential, it's human expertise extending themselves to another planet.
Like the second one would be the American flag.
No, yeah. Well,
I mean, just right after. Just
I mean, actually.
Great thing, it's a great moment, we're all going to be, but like, USA.
To be honest, the second flag is going to be the Martian flag, right? So the first one will be picture the Earth. The
a red flag, Brian.
No. Specifically,
then we plan
actually,
a Martian flag. Then we plant a space flag, and then we plant the snacks we ate on the way there flag. Fine, whatever. We do all that. American.
Mars has its own flag. It was announced back in the late 90s. Did you guys? I remember it being a. There was an Esquire magazine article talking about it, but it's basically like a Eastern European flag.
It's got a video flag.
Got red, green, and blue bands from left to right.
It's an ugly flag.
That is to represent the terra formation of Mars. Red,
it's an
green,
ugly
and blue
flag.
You going to let Croatia have it next? Flag judgment with Andrew Main.
Oh, I will. You know, like, I mean, stars and stripes. Granted, our flag wasn't the most original one, but I love our flag. But you know, flag I love is like, man, I love Brazilians and how much they love their flag. Like, as much pride as we take in ours, damn, you know, you Brazilians, you guys, I've seen that flag more than anything else.
I love the Brazilian flag because it kind of looks like it came off a coffee tin. Right, like
just it
like,
does. It does. It's or a soup canister or whatever. Which, like that's the safety seal that you have to break.
Yeah, like it is. Like, it has like that. It's kind of its era, but it's sort of it's transcended into classic. Like, but yeah, no. The man, Brazilians, they got a thing for that flag, man. They love running with it. They love talking about it. It's the best.
So we're gonna have, you know, the commander of the Martian mission, the first person to set down on Mars. She's gonna be out there. She's gonna be holding this, and now I have this flag and commentators. A flag first proposed by Andrew Main on the Weird Things podcast, with both images of the Earth on either side. She's about to plant it, and some Brazilian's gonna come running across.
Brazil!
You know, suffocate and die, but with a big grin on his face.
Oh,
big,
dude, big having a great time. Face.
So before we move forward, we should take a moment and thank all the folks that make Weird Things possible. If you are one of our fabulous patrons over at patreon.com/weirdthings, that's patreon.com/weirdthings. We got nearly just over 400 of you guys keeping us on the regs. You guys make magic possible. Can't thank you enough.
Well, let's also get into this. We got some new Andrew Hannon at it, but Bryce, why don't you give the haps on all the new private RSS feed action that Patreon is providing for us?
Yeah, so previously we put out After Things, the sister show of this podcast about creativity and professional work, and previously we've released that time exclusive on Patreon, but there was... If you listen to that podcast on a podcast app, there was no way for you to get those episodes before they went public on Wednesday.
Yeah. Previously, the only way for us to get stuff early was by giving an unlisted YouTube link. And for a lot of people, that's not...
Well, and what we would do specifically for Weird Things is we would send we would make a post on Patreon and you would have to download it or listen via the Patreon app. But now Patreon has unveiled a new feature where every person can get an RSS feed for a podcast. So we've unlocked that on Weird Things. So if you are a Weird Things patron and you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, you'll see on the side audio RSS link. That is your private link. It reacts to your patronage level. So if you're at the dollar plus pledge level on Weird Things, you will get a feed with After Things in it, as well as any other bonus stuff that we throw up on there. And it's not a private or a protected RSS, so you don't have to do login stuff, which is a hassle and not every app supports. If you are already a patron, you should have got an email by now with your private link. If you're a new patron, you'll get the link once you pledge, or you can find it on the Patreon page, just on the right here. It's audio RSS link.
Yeah, but essentially, this is all that matters. You just enter that into your podcatcher, into your iTunes app, right on your phone, and now all of a sudden you get everything directly pumped to you. You don't have to go through a middleman.
That's right. You'll get it on Sunday night when we put all the posts up on Patreon, instead of waiting for Wednesday when it goes public for everybody. So check that out.
We'll hear it first.
Can we talk about robots taking over everything?
Yeah, I just one more thing. I just want to ask some predictions from you guys.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so on Tuesday, Elon Musk goes and makes his announcement. Let's just presume it's going to be, this is our rocket. This is how it's going to go there. Our plan is to go to 2026. And one of the things I get into in the post is I talk about how to finance this is creating what I call the Martian Exploration Corporation, MXC, a separate entity for the purpose of doing this and putting it out, getting investment, exploitation of, you know, the opportunities, et cetera, and all that. And I kind of think that might be the model he does. You want it to be separate from SpaceX, because if MXC fails, you don't want SpaceX to suffer. So I get in the idea of the Martian Exploration Corporation. I get in things too, like a Martian Commodities Exchange and other things like that, and kind of just dig a little bit in there. But I think that's my goal. My guess is he's going to have, this is the hardware, this is the mission, and this is the economic model. He needs three things. He needs the physical hardware and a time ramp for when we have the stuff ready, presuming funding. Two is he needs to have what the mission's going to be, the long-term colonization. Three, you need a business model to explain how we're going to pay for it and how we're going to get there. So I think those are the three things that are going to happen. Maybe he'll say, I'm going to announce in stages, but I think that's going to be the gist of it. My question for you guys, I'll give you a moment to think about this, is one, what will be the reaction to it, short term, long term? Two, you know, where do you think we're going to be a year or two down the road, assuming that there is this enthusiasm? And I'll give you as a context to think about. When he announced Hyperloop, nobody predicted the enthusiasm there was for Hyperloop, okay? There have been multiple companies have now been funded, okay? You have Hyperloop Technologies, Hyperloop One. You have these multiple companies been funded around this idea. They've had conferences where hundreds of engineers and people have shown up. And I think that, yes, some of this is way speculation and crazy. I think some of the tech, and I think that's going to happen here. There's going to be a lot of boondoggle people, schemes and things like that. But I think that if the past is any example, the excitement that he had on a really effing fast train caused a couple billion dollars of valuation in companies and stuff. What is the plan for conquering another planet going to be? There's going to be tons of criticism, tons and tons of criticism. But if 5% of the population is so excited about this that they're willing to put time and money and energy and efforts to it, it will happen. It doesn't take 100. It doesn't take 95. It doesn't take 50. It just takes small percent. You know, there were far more skeptics of the internet and computer technology than there were believers willing to put their money into it, but it changed the world. So that context, reactions.
I'm going to guess that there will be a heavy reliance on parallels between what he's proposing and where things were at the discovery of the New World. When, like, there's going to be a history lesson where it's going to say, it took 6 months to get from England to New Mexico. And guess what? It takes exactly 6 months to get to Mars or whatever.
The famed London Albuquerque trade route.
Yeah, yes. You know, it's very, very popular.
Turquoise Exchange of Hyde Street.
The Turquoise Express. the cheap Jeep, as they called it. So he also has to sell the world on a benefit. Why? That is what nobody. We knew why we wanted to go to the moon. We wanted to go to the moon so we could beat the Reds. That was the why. And it was sketched around, but like that's what every American was thinking during all of that moonshot time. We don't know what the reason is to go to Mars, and that is what he's got to do.
When you say we don't know, you mean who's we, the general populace,
right? We the outsiders. How about that?
So,
right.
Let me ask you a question here, though. Okay, trying to explain the internet in 1990s to people, you would get this. Yeah, so it's, you know, just another way to send people mail, and that was a catalog online. The voices were so much that, but the people who got it were like, yeah, whatever. We're going to go build this thing anyways. And I think that you did not have, the majority of people didn't understand the value. And I would say even today, don't understand the full value of it. And I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be this, yeah, you got to sell us on it. But I think enough people will be sold on it that'll happen.
Oh, I don't doubt that it'll happen at all. And by the way, for the record, 8-year-old Brian just reached through time and space to tell me that 41-year-old Brian should be really excited that he lives in a world where he opens up the 21st century equivalent of the newspaper in Google News, and one of the headlines reads, Elon Musk's reveals Mars colonization, planned. Like, that's great that we live in that universe.
I don't think that Elon Musk necessarily needs to sell the concept. I think that the one thing that he does need to sell is the certainty that it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
No, if there is an element of confidence, it's that this is going to happen and I'm going to make it happen, and I want as many people to be involved with it as possible. But this train figuratively is leaving the station. So I think what the announcement will be at its best will be as specific and timetable dependent as possible. And you know, because I think that's, all those examples that you gave, Andrew, were all like very like hat over the wall sort of moments. Like they were things that were just going to happen. And like you said, it didn't matter if 5% of the population were the ones really excited about it. As long as they were the right 5%, then the rest of the world wound up catching on to the dance they were dancing.
Are we entering in? Do you think that after the announcement and we get in the practical, because I think there's going to be the announcement. And then I think that you're going to see, like, with, you know, Hyperloop was this thing that was cool, but how to participate in that was challenging. But a lot of people found ways to try to want to get involved. Are we going to see, and I'm going to say yes, we're going to see weeks and a few months afterwards, you're going to see a lot of these existing space startup companies, people developing CubeSats and people trying to develop, you know, exploitation of space resource, things like that. They're going to announce kind of like, yeah, we're part of it. Like, you know, like, yeah, we're internet companies too. Yeah, we're part of that. And I think that we're going to see fundraising. I think we're going to see IPOs, and we're going to see companies that are going to start to form based upon the idea of this Martian as a platform kind of thing. So a year from now, I think it'll take a year before it becomes real. I think it'll take a year before it really becomes kind of real. But then you hear about, you'll start first be like, yeah, that's crazy. That's fun. That's neat. And then as you have startups and stuff, a year from now, you're going to be talking to people like, oh, yeah, no, I work for a Martian startup. And our goal is to develop these, you know, mini little, you know, shoebox sized diggers and rovers that can do mining. So, and, you know,
That brings me to my real prediction. My substantive prediction is I predict he will announce launch dates and a schedule. Like, if he unveils what looks like a train schedule, like, we are now, there's this much space. This is when stuff is going round trip.
Well, you know, well, Brian, we've had that now with the announcement, you know, Red Dragon, by the way, which is SpaceX announced that they're sending a rocket in 2018, hopefully they can make that window. Their plan is to send a rocket to Mars. NASA announced this week, NASA announced what their participation is on that program. And Musk said this is the first rocket that's part of that schedule that will eventually lead to humans going there. So I think, yeah, I think he'll probably double down on that. But they've said yes. We're starting this thing now to send rockets there. And I think we might find out that, you know, they're going to open up some of the cargo capacity on there too on Red Dragon. You know, if you wanted to put, you know, like, you know, what's a kilogram worth to a private company that says, you know, it's going to be extremely limited. This thing's not going to have like rovers popping out the doors or something. I mean, that would be awesome. But, you know.
Justin, what about you?
I that's what I think. I mean, I think it is going to be timetable dependent. You know, it has to be. Yeah. Like, yeah. if this is the difference between them announcing, I mean, like, it's no secret that SpaceX wants to go to Mars and has designs and has a plan internally to do it, right? And they have announced as much of that as possible. So if he's going to come out and make a big deal about it, then yeah, no, you're right, Brian. It's the train schedules. It's not the idea. It's not the equipment. It's, this is when we're leaving. Pack your crap.
Right. If you go to SpaceX.com/Mars, you get a page and the... they have a feed that says, watch the live stream. It's in 44 hours. And the tagline is making humans an interplanetary species.
I mean, yeah, he's certainly not being coy about that as a mission statement, you know. No, I'm really excited. I'm sure we'll talk about it all next week. Before we get into other stuff, real quick, did you guys happen to see this video of a Japanese robot called Pepper that can learn by watching things?
I've seen Pepper before. I didn't see the latest video. I saw the link.
This latest video is just somebody demonstrating the ball and cup game, where there's mm-hmm. a ball tied to a string that's attached to a cup, and you kind of swing it up, and if you're skilled, it'll land. There's 70 trials of it eating crap, and then the last one it nails, and then pretty much it nails all of them immediately afterward. It's remarkable to me because we as a species tend to think in linear progress, not in geometric progression. Whereas computers, like the moment the computer got it right once, it became a matter of refining with microscopic variations mm-hmm. and being able to execute every single time, which is, I tweeted it out with the, you know, with the snark comment of anyone who doesn't believe that robots are going to drive all our cars needs to watch this, because
really crazy for you to make an aggressive statement on driverless cars.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm going way off brand with this one, but it's just astonishing to me how people are like, yeah, no, still robots will never. Robots will never have the split-second decision-making capability that a human does. And it's like, I just don't understand how anyone can believe that face of evidence like this.
Well, Brian, I remember that there are we're all too happy, and certainly we're examples of that, to prefer opinions on things we know little about, that we know very little about, and we assume our knowledge is roughly approximate to the person we're discussing things with. But in what frequently happens, you get in discussions with people and you realize they have no idea how these systems work. They have no idea what's really going on there. And, you know, one of the things that's been, you know, fascinating, that's sort of right out there, that kind of is sort of beyond a lot of people, is, you know, like, you hear the term machine learning. I'm like, machine learning. Well, in machine learning is why search results are getting better, and why you can actually talk to computers and can figure out roughly what your words are. And yeah, we can point out the flaws, but it's rolled apart from where it was 10 years ago. You know, when Elon Musk talked about why they're going to be using, you know, more radar data with the Tesla cars, it's because they've got, you know, billions of miles or hundreds of millions of miles of data of all this coming back in there going, oh, these are all the different parameters, all the different things you might see on a roadway. And when you start applying that to robots like this, you know, if you want a robot to go into a kitchen or go into a restaurant and clear a table, you know, it doesn't have the advantage that we have of a billion years of evolution designing really good systems for understanding objects, what's not an object, what's the background and all that. But it's catching up really fast. And so machine learning for recognizing images, like, you've seen these systems that can look at an image and tell you what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at the flaws, but the fact that it gets 80% right is insane. And so robots are going to get much more progressively intelligent and scarier as every single robot optical system and feedback system starts contributing to a cloud of data, and it learns faster and faster and faster and faster.
Yeah. Well, and you think about, like, you know, Watson, you know, has this, you know, it's essentially the same cloud of data that all the way back to beating Garry mm-hmm. Kasparov and then mm-hmm. winning Jeopardy and then now solving medical diagnoses and now cooking or whatever. Like, yep. It's all essentially just a reproduction of the same entity, right? The same decision-making algorithm.
So that Pepper robot Brian showed us, it finally figured out how to catch the ball in the cup, right? Now every robot connected into that cloud data has that functionality. You know, you watch some of the stuff we're doing with drones and precision drone flight and how they self-correct and how their ability, like an off-the-shelf drone that you can buy for a few hundred dollars, you know, quadcopter, the stuff that's built into there for image tracking and stabilization is beyond anything that was in an aircraft 10 years ago. And that's progressing. So yeah, I'm with you, Brian. I think that it's we see the failure points, and we're ignoring the incredible amount of successes. And I prefer Alexa to Siri because I don't like the way Siri necessarily functions. Where I go, hey Siri, and I gotta wait for this beep beep, which is not a natural thing. If I had to talk to you guys and wait for you to go beep beep for me to know that you're listening, wouldn't call you as much.
I mean, you have had to do that, but that was with Skype issues. But
yeah,
it was not fun.
So, then what is the other side of this tunnel then? Like where do we get, like, is there a cultural moment wherein we say, okay, well, this is definitely better? Or is it just the creeping normalization of we rely on computers?
I mean, here's the frustrating part. And the good news is eventually there'll be an artificially intelligent algorithm that will call everyone out for being hypocrites. But everybody, the line right now is robots will never ... And everybody loves saying it. And then the moment robots do it, everybody is going to claim, well, I've always said robots are the future. Robots are great. And, you know, I'm so glad I have mine. It programs this and it handles the schedule. And
I mean, there's the average person and there's the pundits. You know, the average person will say that, but the pundits will sort of reframe the thing. You know, like robots will never beat us at chess because of blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, it beat us at chess, but it had to use da, 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 da. You know, right.
Moving the goalposts, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they're not. And like, I was hoping they wouldn't beat us at Go. Yeah, they beat us at Go. And it's always, it's going to be, you know, you're going to have to the point that you're going to have somebody sitting down having a conversation with an amazing facsimile of a human being that looks just like and talks. It's like, yeah, you look human. And yeah, you can understand what I'm saying. But when you look at that tree or that flower, it doesn't feel to you the way it feels to me. And you're going to be like, the robots are going to be like, whatever, dude.
Whatever. I wrote this poem about that flower. What do you think? And you're weeping openly. And you're like, these are fake tears induced by your fake.
A roller coaster gives me an emotional response. It doesn't make it real. And that was, you know, prescient as ever, you know, was Alan Turing, who was kind of saying, well, yeah, we can have this philosophical argument over, are my internal experiences more real than your internal experiences? But because they are by definition internal, we can't know, then we have to go by external criteria. And that's why, well, if you think it's human, got to treat it like human.
Yeah. Or at least, I don't know. That's a whole rabbit hole we could descend down some other time. I thought that was an extraordinary video, though, that sort of portrayed in black and white circumstances.
So what happens, Brian, when you're in a restaurant and Pepper comes up to your table and says, oh, you know, let me take your order?
I speak politely because here's the sad, dark fact is that when you're at a restaurant and somebody comes up and says, let me take your order, you don't really think of that person as a human being. You think of them. I mean, that's already the reality that we live in. They are outside of Dunbar's number.
They're
not a human being. The only reason you treat them as a human being is because you don't want to be seen as being rude.
All right. I'm just going to point out here that I actually have people who work at Wendy's will come down and sit down at my table to have their lunch with me because I at least pretend to treat them like humans.
It's fine. But every single time, every single person, whoever does anything for you, they're all humans to you. You are the one lone outlier who somehow magically defies Dunbar's number.
No, you
could process all of them as part of your tribe.
I agree that the outside of the people that you know, I don't interact with a lot of people, so I've got a lot of room in my Dunbar number, just so you know. But I know I absolutely get you, and I think absolutely get you is that we have this habit when we get up, you know, we go to Walgreens, we go somewhere and we get frustrated and we yell at that cashier and we do not treat them like a human who is just, you know, a person working there trying to do a job who does not have that control. We make them the corporate, you, why have you done this? They're like, I don't know, my manager made that decision and they were told by management above them to do it. And I have no power to do that. Please don't yell at me.
Right, right. And by the way, of course, I'm polite.
Brian is not polite.
Please, all right.
Although you're actually proving your point because you only made that point that you're polite in the weight of other people's judgment, right? Like you didn't start off saying, anyway, I'm always polite, but also I look at them in a different way. It was, these people are subhuman. But whoa, whoa, whoa. If you're going to judge me, I want you to reveal my true heart that I think they are all special.
No.
So what's Brian, we're going to let you off the hook. We're just busting your balls on it.
Yeah,
so
no.
What happens, though, when Pepper's at the restaurant as our waiter or waitress or wait bot, wait entity? I don't know the proper – the cis robot heteronormative.
Cis robot. Cis robots.
What happens when, one, a a lot of people are going to be pissed. A lot of people who never want to work that job are still going to be upset. Listen, don't underestimate the outrage of people who are not directly involved in a situation. In fact, it's probably greater than the people who are affected, who are just like, all right, I just got to figure out how to live my life. That's wonderful. You have the time to be angry and upset. Yes, I can't be a, you know, I can't get the server here at Outback Steakhouse because now they're using, you know, robots with Australian accents. But people are going to be outraged. People are going to be, I'm not saying majority, but I'm saying it's, we've seen in this age how a small, extremely vocal people who are powered by feeling they're arguing on the behalf of other people can create a tremendous amount of outcry. And I guarantee first restaurant that tries to put these things in place to serve, and even though it's going to make things, there is the rational economic argument that, hey, we're able to do cheaper food prices. The few employees that we do have do get paid better, more compensated. They're not having to do the higher risk stuff. It won't matter.
And by the way, just to clarify, because I'm seeing comments in the chat that are driving me nuts, if you're not familiar, Dunbar's number is the upper limit of what our brains are physically capable of processing as other human beings that that we care about our standing with. And that's the reason that, you know, you know, as far as most of us are concerned, we take our trash out to the curb and the magical trash genie makes the trash go away. We have a very hard time thinking about Osama bin Laden as a man who had hopes and dreams and body odor and made people smile because in our minds he has to be a monster and whatever. He's outside of Dunbar's number. And for the record, I tip like a drunken millionaire, and I'm the best person who would ever serve you or who would ever have you. I love everyone. I love everyone.
Drunken,
and don't any of you guys think otherwise.
Millionaire who were like, oh, I forgot my cash and my credit cards. He's a millionaire.
You're killing me.
It's fun because we know Brian's generous, but we're going to make it.
I mean, listen, there's number one, there's nowhere for Brian to hide because now that he talks about how much he tips, everyone's going to wipe people rich.
It's fine.
There's, I mean, you already see this in the outsourcing conversation.
Yep.
Right? Like, you know, there's obviously human pain to the fact that people want to move plants from America to somewhere else. And there are rational economic arguments about how even people who have lost their jobs are probably better off in the long run with companies outsourcing. But that is not the case that you see made before you, you know, when, you know, it's a loss of job situation. So
I guess my point is that it's been the, you know, Milton Friedman used to talk about people get upset about the number of jobs that leave the country, but they ignore the number of jobs that leave the planet. And, you know, and that's what happens is that as a job becomes as the profit margin declines, you move it to places where labor is cheaper, and then eventually that labor gets replaced by automation. And that's when a lot of things has happened. Let's say a lot of manufacturing that was going to China then got moved to India and then got moved to Vietnam, and then it went nowhere. It vanished because of the amount of robotics that's doing that. You know, you're the people we complain, you hear these the complaints about, oh, these Chinese factories where they make the stuff. One, like, you know, the really high tech factories are really nice places to work comparatively. Two, those people are actively being replaced by robots. You know, that's the goal, is to say we can, you know, what's cheaper than a person? No person. What happens when it's visible? What happens when you're in that restaurant and it is the waiter is a robot, the person preparing the food's a robot? When you go into a store and it's a robot that comes up to serve you, and we know rationally it's going to be better service, it'll be lower cost, it's going to be that. I think it's just, I'm just, you know, in dread and participating that, you know, the first company that starts to roll this stuff out in a visible way is going to have a backlash.
I mean, I'm kind of shocked, and I've been shocked since 07 with the iPhone, right? As soon as the idea of a rich, even mobile web interface became something that you could expect on your phone, I kind of thought that there was going to be some Buffalo Wild Wings or Chili's or something like that that would just give you the option to not have a waiter.
There's some places that do that now.
Yeah, and in fact, I think it was at a Chili's I experienced the first one, and I was surprised. I was first delighted that it's like, oh, I don't have to talk to a person, and then I was surprised by how quickly I felt like this is tedious. I wish I could just wave my hands and say, bring me something with broccoli on it.
Well, they had at the, again, another plug for Wendy's, like the Wendy's I go to, they tried those terminals, like the kiosk terminals, to go up and go put your order in.
And they had two of these things, and they were, it was a horrific user interface. It was horribly done. It was, and they were slow, they were buggy, they didn't work, and eventually they ripped them out. It was a pilot test program. And you're like, and it's one of these things, like, I want to know, do they know why it didn't work? Do they know why it was a failure? It wasn't a failure because they had these kiosks. It was a failure because the interface was horrific and confusing, and it was buggy, and it was slow. And you were like, you're in your position, Brian. You're like, screw this. I just want to talk to a person.
Well, I mean, and that's why I always think the future isn't kiosks, and it's not things that, like, Chili's that have their own UIs to them. It's your phone, right? It's your app. And being able to, because, like, you know, at this point, I've ordered on Grubhub enough that I know their standardized app format. You know, if you had something like that, I don't think it's hard to find a visual language where you can easily do stuff or have previous orders stored if you always order the exact same thing.
Well, and this is definitely where I think we're headed, is that we'll have a very intimate personal relationship with our AI who gets us, who already knows our address, phone number, all that stuff. You know, and it's like, just like, all you'll have to say is, I'm hungry. And your AI will know, like, well, on the way back, there's a Wendy's. When you go to Wendy's, you like the number 6, no mayo, substitute chili for the fries to get a Diet Dr. Pepper. They don't have Diet Dr. Pepper here.
Even beyond the far future, right? Like, there is nothing standing between, like, us the next time I'm in Austin, us going to a bar and just, you know, ordering food and ordering each round of drinks off an app, right? Like that could happen. There's no
Here's the thing. So I had a recent experience at a Mexican chain restaurant, which I won't name. Mm-hmm. That has an app that I love, and I love using the app because it makes it easy for me to customize my food the way I want it. Sure. And I go in there, send in the order. I show up in there to go pick up the order, like I've done many times.
So they bring my tray to pick up the Mexi-Melt and Chalupa. Go ahead.
I get my tray. I sit down and I open up one of the things, and they got it wrong. They forgot, we'll call it Chipotle sauce. And it's not a proprietary name. They forgot the Chipotle sauce. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, which is a bit of a tragedy, and thank you for your understanding in this moment. So I forgot that I had ordered three of these quesadillas, and they forgot the Chipotle sauce. So I go up to the counter. I'm like, hey, they forgot the Chipotle sauce, okay? He relays it to the manager in the back. The manager in the back says, I'm not remaking them. I'll have to give them a cup, which, one, great. You know, this is wonderful customer service right there. So they give me a little cup of Chipotle sauce. I pour it on the first quesadilla, and then it's out. I'm like, oh, I got two more quesadillas, and I'm not an animal. I can't eat this without my sauce. So I go back up. I said, hey, listen, so I only had enough for one. Manager's like, we have to charge you. Now, 35 cents. I don't care about 35 cents. But I'm in a situation where they screwed up my order. Guy refused to fix the order and then wanted me to pay extra to compensate for that. Now, the app worked great. The app was fine. You know, the kid at the front of the counter was super polite. But that human element in there, that human element so frustrated me because it was this, like, it was too complicated. We screwed it up. It's on you. I'm not going to fix this. It's like, gosh, you know, it's one of those moments where you're like, you know, you're like, man, I want that element to be replaced.
Hey, man, I got a pick.
That's nice. You have a pick, but I have a journey quest.
Oh my gosh, we're running long on this one. Go for it.
Do you want a journey quest?
I don't know. Do we? It's up to you guys.
Nick, it's a bit short installment of journey quest. Here, all right. Okay?
When last we were journeying, if I remember correctly, we were bicycling as fast as we could down a ravine. We separated. We rejoined. We found a cave. We went into the cave. And we were about to see something.
Well, no, so there was a dead end. A dead end. Our pursuers were about to snatch us when all of a sudden we were led into a tiny cavern by what seems to be a friendly.
So you had a voice called you, said, come this way if you want to live, right? And you're like, this is really weird. You entered into this cavern and you looked all around you. And it was an amazing collection of memorabilia, comic books, movie posters, all the stuff. Just the remnants of sort of what maybe kind of like a nerdy sort of person might want to hold on to from the previous world. There are some lanterns lit around there. You see that it goes on. There's a bed. There's a refrigerator plugged into some sort of electric power bank or something. This person's been living there,
There's an older guy. He's about 60 years old. He's got some tan skin. He's got a bandana. He's like, "You're survivors." And you're like, "Yeah, we're survivors." It's like, "I've been waiting for you."
Waiting for us to show up?
Like in this ravine?
Like, how did you know we were going to be here? Also, hi, I'm Brian. This is Justin.
I'm Clive.
Clive,
and I'm a big fan of your shows, guys, by the way.
Shows we've been doing before the end of the world or after?
And your van podcast. That was really good.
Does he flash the Diamond Club symbol? Like, do we get the gang sign so we know
Flashes this, and he's like, "Listen, by the way, bicycles? No. Unicycles."
Oh, my God. No, this guy. See, look, he just made us twice as efficient because what are we doing pedaling two wheels around when it could be one?
Okay. And now you're looking around, you're like, "Man, Clive, you've got like a really good setup here." And, you know, like, I mean, this, did you do all of this after the apocalypse? And Clive's like, "No, I knew it was coming. I had a vision."
You had a vision. How specific was this vision? Did it just say, "Get ready because stuff's going to get wacky," or was it like specifically there's going to be a virus that will wipe out 99%?
I saw bodies lying in the streets. I saw flies in the air. I saw sickness, and I knew I needed to get away.
Hey, Clive, where did you live and what did you do before the end of the world?
I worked at Wells Fargo.
Right on.
I got out of there too quick.
All right, and where did you live geographically? Did you live around here? Or did you make your way?
I lived, you know, just north of Austin.
Well, okay, real quick, how did you have this vision? Did you just stay up? Were you doing peyote mushrooms? Well,
my grandmother made me a special ceremonial potion, and I would take this from time to time in my life when I was faced with difficult choices, and I would have visions, and I would see things. I saw this coming. Saw you coming.
We're kind of big fans of the scientific method, just like, you know, just so I know that this wasn't like a lucky coincidence, because I'm sure a lot of people thought the world was going to end and then the world ended. Like, were there other times he had a vision and it comes out to be true?
Yes.
Okay.
I bought a lot of Facebook stock.
Oh, wow. So you got money. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually own this cave. I bought the entire cavern system.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. And this is all from your vision? You don't happen to have any of that left over, do you?
I do, because I need you two to go on your own vision quests.
I mean, this is just, but I'll know the future when I take this, right?
You will know what you're supposed to know. So he gets up, walks over to the refrigerator, opens it up.
So here's the deal, Clive. I'm a huge fan of you saving us from these marauding murderers. By the way, do you know that we were being pursued by a bunch of marauding?
He knows everything. It's pondclive.com right over here. He's got this figured out, man.
Yes. I did. That wasn't part of the vision. I knew you would come to me. You would come to me in refuge.
See, he's got the magic sauce.
Okay. All right, Brian. 2 minutes.
Yeah, all right, one second.
I'm
going
to go
second,
to the restroom over here.
Look, man, I've read enough comic books. I mean, you realize, like, it was drugs that made Captain America who he is. He was a little wimp, and then he became big and strong because of drugs.
All right, man.
I'm not even joking. That's a real thing.
A hard line against psychotropic drugs, all right?
You're telling me Dr. Strange don't get a little strange when he gets strange?
I'm all for it, right? But we need to keep the eye on the prize. We have now evaded. We got out of this situation with the Salvation People.
I know. And now we got the chance to really get ahead. This could be huge for our podcast, Justin.
Okay.
This is 100% of our listening demographic.
All we need to do is make sure, and I'm not saying I can't be argued to this point, how does this fit in with us getting to Los Angeles within the next week?
All I'm saying is that if there's secrets to be learned, better we know them than not know them. Do you want to know the future? I want to know the future.
We don't know whether or not he is actually learning the secrets.
All right, look, there's only two possibilities. One, we learn the future. Two, we get wicked high, and I'm fine with either of these.
Okay, yeah, number one, your whole family's dead. I might still have people out there, and I would like to try to get to them.
Yeah, I got nothing to live for. I'm going to take, in fact, I walk away from Justin, and I was like, how do I take it? Do I smoke it? Do I inhale it? Do I drink it?
Clive comes back, and he says, well, each of you have been drinking a Fresca since you got here, but actually that is the magic substance.
I immediately grab Justin's out of his hands and drink the dregs that are left just so I can get a little bit more future high than he is.
All right, Clive, number one, we're going to go ahead and just let me just lay this down since we're building our personal relationship. Dosing is never cool.
All right, I can't hear him because I'm tonguing. I've now ripped open the aluminum can and I'm licking the insides of the Fresca.
And now, Justin, you're watching Clive's face melt in front of you and regroup into all sorts of weird animated things. Brian's hair spikes come back and start to touch the ceiling of the cavern.
They grow from inside my scalp.
Yeah, you're feeling really, really good right now. And you're like, all right, Clive, we're going to pick this up later, Mom. I'm going to sit down and take a nap before school. And you sit back down. Each of you has a seat. And in this dream you go into, you actually open up your email and you see what your dream is.
Dude, I just had a visage. I don't want to say what happened, but I'm just going to assume that Justin learned the same truth that I learned. By the way, for the record, if you guys are wondering where your Patreon dollars go, it goes to incredible production efforts by Bryce Neshcom Castillo, because as we've been talking, the background has been changing from the Southwest desert to a cave and now a psychedelic tripped out background. Hey, Justin.
Each of you will see a part of the vision, not the same vision.
Wait, real quick. This is the truth. This is like what's going to happen.
It's the truth, but you know, there is a mountain has places many perspectives. Some stand on the mountain, some look up at the mountain.
All right, I'm not.
Some fall off the mountain.
I'm not super comfortable with. I mean, there's parts of my dream that I'm really great with. I'm super into.
Oh yeah. Oh no, let's all get high. Let's get high.
Hold on.
Like a real straight shooter. He sees the future. We could be Doctor Strange.
I mean, this would be just like you, wouldn't it? This is exactly what I was told.
What
would happen?
Brian? I can go first.
You know what? It doesn't matter what you saw, because what I saw was you stabbing me in the back. You stabbed me in the back. Just like you're doing right now. Backstabber.
Physically stabbing you in the back.
No. Actually, it's just implied that you stabbed me in the back. I mean, I assume there's a reason. I saw your head on a pike with the word treason underneath it.
What's your vision?
Your head on a pike with the word treason underneath it.
All right. Maybe I meant traitor, but treason works.
Well, here's my vision. Which I was dosed into, for the record. Again.
You don't have to share this vision, by the way. You can keep the vision.
No. I wanted to just ask Clive.
And by the way, hold on.
Get to LA.
I'm talking about the important parts of the vision. There's other parts of the vision.
Brian's the one who wanted to go do some medicine work. So we're in a yurt somewhere sweating out.
Am I the only one starving?
God knows what peyote this dude's grandma put in his. The Mr. Bib.
I mean, do you guys have like some Doritos or Cheetos?
Oh, I've got all sorts of snacks for your munchies.
Let's walk and talk, Justin.
Remember when they ran out of Twinkies? He opens up a cupboard that's actually a closet that goes on for like 50 feet filled with every kind of Hostess.
Okay. Ryan, I would suggest you not eat any of that.
No, that's fine. It's fine. I've already had two in my mouth.
Start to restrain Brian.
No, I'm still stuffing it in, and then I start shouting, treason, treason! This is what I was talking about, treason!
Here's my vision, Brian. We are
now, hold on a second. I've got to tell you that I've got on the radio, I've heard there are more survivors. There's been a busload of survivors that have been driving up from South America in search of salvation.
Brian.
What?
Here's my vision. We continue our journey, and everybody around us keeps dying. And I slowly realize that the reason why they're dying are not marauders, and it's not the illness, it's you. you are murdering people.
I now have like at least four Twinkies in my mouth.
I slap all four of them out of Brian's mouth.
And then I grab another one and I just shrug and I was like, it's not what my polling data says. And I just eat another Twinkie. And it's in.
Oh, I start to punch Brian in the stomach and make him throw up the Twinkies.
And I shrug. I'm like, this was all in the vision. All of this, just like I predicted. If you don't mind.
What else is in the vision? That bus that dude just told us about, you kill everybody on it because you think they're demons.
That's not how I remember it. Maybe you were crazy in my vision.
Maybe you should stop eating this man's crazy Twinkies. He already dosed us once. What the hell do you think is in the rest of it?
I grab another Twinkie, but then realize I'm just gumming my knuckles. And then I say, excuse me, I need to go to the restroom. Then I get out and I go to the bathroom. And then when I'm in the bathroom, I lay back and I just smile.
The cave bathroom?
Huh?
The cave bathroom?
The cave bathroom. The bath area. Bath. I lay among the human waste and just close my eyes with a beatific smile. And I think to myself, like, worshiping, huh? Right on. Worshiping. Cool. All right. I got this.
Well, Brian, perhaps you can allay Justin's fears. I know not what you dreamed or what you saw, but if he sees something in you, you could maybe convince him he has nothing to fear by telling him what you saw.
Can I have a word with Clive? Clive, can you come over?
All right. Yes, look. Brian, we're having a word over here.
All right, not for nothing, but in my dream, everything was awesome, and the world was great, and everybody was happy, and, Justin, it turns out, he had a little bit of the traitor in him. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, do I really want to even tell him my vision?
That's up to you. You know, how you feel like you can trust him?
No. Well, I mean, I did up until this moment. And then you gave me some funny drugs and I had a vision. But now...
Totally unrelated.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm feeling like probably not. You know, I'm just going to play this one close to the vest. Hey, Justin! If people are coming in a bus, it seems like we got to go meet them, right? Welcome them.
No, you are not getting anywhere near the bus.
I mean, that's fine. You know what? You're right. How about you, as my number one, go bring them to me? Because I'm sure they all want to meet me. Brian. I'll stay here with the Twinkies. And do you have any more of those Frescas? Those are really...
I go over to Clive, and I pull Clive... close by his, you know, shirt. I say, hey, listen, man, I'm just going to say for the third time, dosing never cool.
So, I knew you would say that.
That means that you are at least pretend on some level to be a decent human being. Well, how about this one, Kreskin? Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go over there and I'm going to get that bus. And I'm going to find out which of the people on that bus want to go to Los Angeles. And I'm going to get Brian on that bus, and we're going to drive it from here to Los Angeles, unless you have a car that can allow us to do it without them.
Jude, no, I'm more of a kind of a non-car guy.
Okay, well, thanks for the weird acid. You stay here with Brian. I'm going to go hail down these survivors. I'm going to get this bus, and then we are going to get the hell out of here.
Hey, Clive! Clive,
get more high.
Clive,
let him get higher.
Clive,
please continue to feed him fake Fresca.
High five, Clive, because you're my five, Clive. And let's get in the hive.
Clive, look me in the eye and tell me you're not going to get him higher.
High five.
Oh, listen,
Clive.
No man can tell another man what his fate should be.
Five, Clive, this guy.
All right, then let's put it this way: either you don't get him higher, or there's going to be a problem the next time I come back.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that each of you needs to think about that vision and how you got to that place.
Five.
Sometimes our first track is the track that causes the thing.
Live at five with Clive in the hive. That's what we're doing, you and me. And
maybe you should take your high friend with you, Justin.
This rock is a camera. Look, hello, San Diego. It's...
All right, Brian. We're not letting you near the drugs anymore. Let's go.
It wore off a half hour ago, by the way.
Wait, what?
It wore off. Your friend's just
wait. So you're saying I'm just a dumbass?
Damn it!
You oregano smoking asshole.
You know what? Yeah, Clive. You know, all right. Look, let's get out of here, Justin. My followers away. The people in the bus await.
Let's go. Come on.
All right.
Clive stands there, reaches into his belt, and pulls out a gun. Just one more thing.
What is it?
Next time on Journey Quest.
All right. I'm excited. I think a lot of good's going to come out of this bus full of people.
We shall see. So, gentlemen, let's do our picks now.
Yeah, man, I got to pick that article about Dunbar's number. Where I first heard it was in an article written by David Wong about a decade ago called What is the Monkey Sphere? It's very, very good. Written September 30th, 2007. And I think you should read it.
Cool.
My pick is the remake for The Magnificent Seven. I saw it on Friday. I'm not going to tell you it's like the best movie ever. But if you
better really, than all the other movies, that's all I'm going to say.
if you really like Westerns, like if you are a fan of the genre and you are tickled by the idea of a movie just kind of doing all the Western tropes, but with modern charismatic actors and Vincent D'Onofrio doing an impossibly silly voice, then go see the movie. Like, I enjoy it. I don't know if I can recommend it as a great film. It's certainly not a great film to bring people into the Western genre. But if you, like me, are just a fan of dusty people punching each other and you know, doing what's right for the right reasons, then go ahead and check it out.
Excellent. My pick, and it's been a game that I've been playing. I still haven't seen all the way through. It's not as I don't love it as much as I loved the earlier game by them. But let me pronounce the name right. Remember the game called Machinarium?
Oh, yeah, Machinarium?
You're the little robot going around.
You're like a steampunk-looking robot.
Yeah, so the creators of that came out with a new game, which is sort of loosely tied into like this other sort of IP called Samerset? Let me get the name right. And you're this little space gnome going around trying to...
Samerost 3.
Yeah, there you go. Samerost 3. So I never got into 1 or 2, but it's fun. It's got a kind of cool little soundtrack, fun little puzzles and stuff. I'm not a guy I don't like games where there's a big time component, and if I don't, you know, solve something in a short time, it stresses me out. But I like this. It's puzzle solving. The puzzles often are very music based, and I have no musical skill whatsoever. So, you know, what somebody would solve in like 10 seconds can take me 20 minutes to try to get the right keys right. But you're this little space gnome going around. It's a very green, weird sort of thing. You might fly to a piece of driftwood with little termite creatures in there. You've got this strange little magical mushroom that you float around on. There's this puzzle with lemurs and hot tubs where you've got to balance the water back and forth. So I've been enjoying this. It's been fun. It's been a very relaxing, sort of tranquil game for me. So it's, I believe it's on iOS. I think it's on other platforms as well. So that is my pick.
Sweet. Right on.
And everybody should watch the SpaceX announcement on
44 hours.
For now. This has been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.